Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, and welcome to episode 29 of Write Club. For writers and readers everywhere. I'm Steph, and we've got the whole team here again today. So that's Heather, Pat, Teresa, Nicola, and Linda.
Hi!
This week on Write Club, we've got our usual packed agenda. Heather's been experimenting with dialogue and colloquialism, so we're really looking forward to hearing a reading from her work in progress. And Pat will be staying on that theme when she talks to us about some interesting words. Later, we're going to discuss the use of controversial language in writing. And by that, we mean things like profanities, blasphemy, words which may be culturally sensitive or require a level of political correctness. Teresa and Nicola met Jill Simpson, former senior lecturer in linguistics at the University of Central Lancashire recently, and we'll be listening to that interview. And after that, we'll be hearing what's on Charlie Bell's bedside table and Linda's nightstand, which is American for bedside table, I believe. But first, Nicola is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Clue one. Described by Pennsylvania Supreme Court Justice Michael Musmano, it's not a book, it's a cesspool, an open sewer, a pit of putrefaction, a slimy gathering of all that is rotten in the debris of human depravity.
Oh, I think...
He didn't like it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right, I'm writing it down.
Anyone got any ideas?
I've got an inkling.
Okay, right. Ideas. Clue two? Mm-hmm. Originally published in France in 1934, the ACLU, whoever they may be, tried to sue the US government that it was illegal to censor the book, but lost its case. Finally, when the novel was published in 1961 by Grove Press, 60 obscenity cases were brought against it in 21 different states.
I have an idea, but I can't remember.
Tell me the first date when it was published in France.
In 1934.
Okay, so it's not the one I first thought of.
Not the one I thought of.
But it's not published until 1961
in America. 60 obscenity cases.
So I changed my mind when I get to clue two.
I have an idea.
Oh, I'm doing well this one, aren't I? Clue three, some particularly find the book's depiction of women and sex deeply misogynistic and offensive.
Ooh. I have an idea.
Okay. I'll give you a bonus clue.
Go on.
The author appeared in the Durrells recently. Because he was a friend of Lawrence Durrell.
Wait a minute.
Not actually in person. Well, I was thinking... D.H. Lawrence, Lady Chatterley's lover. When you said the sexual portrayal of women, maybe women in love, so I don't know.
I thought Lolita.
I've gotcha. It was Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller.
Very good.
It was about his sexual escapades in Paris and his frequent use of the C word, which is why I picked him for this particular episode,
made this
a banned book in the United States.
Yeah. Originally, I put Slaughterhouse 5 because I recently read a letter Kurt Vonnegut wrote to a headmaster who burned his books and banned his books.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was, breaking the first bit. But anyway, we were way off beam.
Yeah, well,
you got us.
And like you say, it must read.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks, Nicola. Well, as I said at the start of the show, Heather's been experimenting with writing dialogue, and in doing so came up with a short piece which she, Pat and Nicola are going to share with you today. Over to you, ladies.
Well, that's the last of you on the bus. Make sure you have your seatbelt fastened and we'll be on our way. We have a couple of new ladies with us today, and I hope that you'll give them a warm Apple Court welcome. Ethel, this is Nellie. Nellie, this is Ethel. You may already know each other.
Godless bugger. Mrs. Buxton, of course we know each other. Sorry to hear about Eric. I always thought he was a nice man. How's your Tracy and those lovely grandchildren of yours? I bet they're growing up fast.
Too fast, if you ask me. It's a wonder they haven't got square eyes. They've always got their noses stuck to the screen of their thingamabobs. Our Tracy's always at their beck and call, and I'll swear they never walk anywhere.
Tell me about it. The twins even get a ride to school and back every day. And they only live round the corner. Remember when we lived next door on Brown Edge and we used to sit on the steps like Piffy on a rock bun and wait for the kids to walk home? It never did them any harm. I remember the fight you and Tracy had when she was a teenager. She'll be getting a taste of her own medicine when your Jill reaches her teens.
Oh, I think Tracy knows she got her already. And she's only 10. I actually heard her tell her mother to mind her own business when she asked her where she was going.
Nigel used to say, there and back to see how far it is. It makes me laugh now, but when he was little he got a thick ear for his cheek.
You can't give him a clap nowadays or they'll report you to Childline.
Ridiculous. A good idea never did anyone any harm. Is Tracy still on her own?
Yeah. I think she's courting, but she doesn't say much to me. She used to be able to talk to her dad, but she won't open up to me. It's probably my fault, because she knows I never liked that Rick. She used to tell me that he'd changed and had got a job, but it never lasted long. He was almost always out of work, and he'd chase anything in a skirt. He used to prefer the ones dressed up to the nines with slap on the face an inch thick. You know the type, fur coat and no knickers. Beats me how she put up with it for so long.
It's a pity she never fancied our Nigel. They would have made a lovely couple. I think he had a thing for her, but she didn't seem to notice him. Why on earth he ended up with Mary, I'll never know. She's always got a bag on with a face like a smacked arse. I don't think I've ever seen that woman smile.
Remember when the three of them used to take a picnic to the gardens? Sugar butties and a bottle of Corporation Pop. He used to play out all day and not get back until it got dark. They had such fun. Nowadays it's hummus, crudities, bottled water and never allowed to play out on their own.
Whatever happened to that little boy who lived next door to you? You know the one, thick as 10 short planks with ears like a taxi with the doors open.
Oh, hey, John. Oh, he's a big wig at the university. I used to see his mum sometimes when I was visiting my sister. Married a woman with a face like the back of a bus. Daddy with lots of money.
Well, I never thought he was a full shilling. I didn't think he'd make much of himself.
What made you think of him after all these years?
I think that's his dad's sister sitting behind us. Between you and me and the gatepost, I think she's pissed as a fart.
How can you tell?
I can smell the gin from here, and her eyes are all squiffy.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have arrived. Gloria and Trixie will help you off the bus, Ethel and Nellie. Tilly will be with you shortly to take your histories and fill in all the paperwork.
Bloody Nora. It's like being on a shower on a school trip when we were nippers.
Only then my feet weren't playing up and I was fit as a flea.
Crikey, I'm spitting feathers. I wonder how long we'll have to wait for a brew.
What a motley crew. I'm not sure I want to spend a day with a bunch of wrinklies.
Stop mithering, woman. We'll have bingo this afternoon.
At least the chairs are comfy.
Mrs. Dakin, I will see you first. Mrs. Geit, I will call you in next.
London Sand, who does she think she is? The Queen of Sheba?
Well done. Yeah, that was lovely.
Really, really well read, and that really brought it to life.
It did.
Yeah.
So, Linda, perhaps we'll talk to you first. Did you understand any of that conversation?
I understood some of it, but there was a lot I didn't, you know. I mean, Gormless Bugger. I have learned that's just, I don't remember what it was. What's a gormless bugger? Somebody that's just annoying you?
A bit stupid, really.
Oh, a bit
not
stupid.
No idea.
Piffy on a rock bun, which is something I really like the sound of, but piffy on a rock bun means...
It just means left to look. So, you know, sort of wait, sitting there waiting.
Oh. So what was piffy on a rock bun, though?
Piffy.
I know what a rock bun piffy. Is, but what's piffy?
Piffy.
What's piffy?
Not the...
What is it? Icing?
No.
Sugar?
I did look it up and there's no... I couldn't find any origin for the word. They just think it was a saying. Rock bun, yes, is a cake.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just means sitting there, you know.
Rock bun's like a currant bun.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. So that's... Mm-hmm. And then I know thick ear and cheek... And clout, because some of the things are, you know, explained simply in the context, but mm-hmm. slap on their face, and it's thick, so I figured that's makeup, but yes. Slap?
Yeah, slap. Slapstick, short for slapstick.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah, makeup from the theatre.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's interesting.
Slapstick was actually
a stick.
Piece of wood.
Yeah, that made a noise, a slapstick, noise. Originally.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But these things evolved.
You slap it on.
You slap it on.
Yeah, okay.
Get your slap on.
And then she's always got a bag on.
Yeah, just miserable.
Oh, yeah. Like she's always complaining about something.
Yeah, always complaining. Okay. Yeah.
And a bottle of Corporation.
That's water.
That's water from the tap.
Oh, really?
The Corporation provided the water back in the day. So, yeah.
Sugar buckies.
That's just sandwich.
Sandwich.
We were.
It's like bread. Sugar.
Sugar sandwiches were a real treat when I was a child. White bread. The other one we used to have, because Heather's in Russia at the moment, my sister, and she sent a picture of a bowl of condensed milk, which was on the breakfast buffet, and she said, white condensed milk sandwich, anyone? Because we used to have that too. Yeah, they're hard to eat, they are.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, obviously, you'd start off, because those are both sweet, you'd start off with a savoury, which was a crisp sandwich.
I knew you were going to say that. Crisp sandwich. My mum still has a crisp.
I love crisps.
Potato chips
in a ham sandwich. Delicious.
If my mum's got nothing in for her lunch, she'll have a crisp sandwich, because there's no shop in the village where she lives.
Potato chips only.
Although she does like the vegetable crisps.
You have to have butter.
That's what makes it a butty.
Oh, okay. Yeah. and what about, let's see, you have, I never thought he was a full shilling, which probably means, like, we would say he's a few bricks short of a load.
Yeah. A few coupons short of a dollar, et cetera.
I don't know what that bit is about the 10 short planks.
It's just an expression. Stupid. More usually you'd say, if somebody's thick, stupid, thick as two short planks, but obviously to take that further, 10 planks are bigger than two.
Well, I thought when I was reading it that he was fat because you mentioned his ears and other physical features. Yeah.
But the other thing that's happened with thick as two or 10 short planks is that people are now called, oh, he's a plank.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's become
short.
Okay. So he's not
if somebody's a bit not bright, you might say he's a bit of a plank.
Pissed as a fart.
Drunk.
There was quite a lot of that at someone's party last night.
Pissed as a fart. Okay. Squiffy. Eyes are squiffy.
Pointing in different directions.
Yeah, with drink.
Skew-whiff and squiffy must be closely related, I thought.
Yeah.
Skew-whiff?
Skew-whiff is again when things are out of
kilter. Oh, okay. Bloody Nora.
Just an expression.
And like being on a chara on a school
chara. That's actually a coach.
Okay. All right. Bunch of wrinklies, like old people.
Yeah.
And then we have blood and sand. Who does she think she is, Queen of Sheba? Blood and sand.
Just a saying. Mm. I think it's where people don't want to swear.
Yes, instead of saying bloody, they say blood and sand.
Yes.
But probably was a silent movie about a sheik or something.
Could have been.
But why? Well, you have so many bloodies. You got Bloody Nora, Blood and Sand, and then just plain bloody. But you consider bloody a swear.
For that generation, it's probably.
And now I've got a challenge about bleeping.
We just have to flag it up at the beginning.
We could just
that
use
we are talking
explicit.
About
yeah, I think
language.
Yeah.
Yeah, poor old Hannah won't be able to hear it. I'll warn her. I'll send her an email.
So you have to listen
so
at home,
listen
Hannah.
You have to listen at home rather than on your work.
Okay, well, quite an adventure learning all this stuff.
I have to say, I think the whole, you know, just to go back to the writing, I think the dialogue is incredible. And, and you being a newcomer to writing dialogue, this being an experiment, is remarkable.
Telling a whole story.
Really? Yes.
Great job.
I wonder if you've ever thought of writing plays.
Much in the style of Victoria Wood.
I haven't. And I think it's the advice that I've had from probably all of you about writing what you know. Mm. And I did, when I first tried to write something along these lines, it wasn't going anywhere. The story was just lost. Mm-hmm. So I thought, right, what do we do? And I used to manage a daycare centre, and so we used to pick people up on the bus and bring them in. Uh-huh. And some of the conversations were, you know, some of the, especially the old ladies, some of the things they would talk about are truly shocking. because there weren't no inhibitions, and they'd just say it as it was. And very, very funny. So that's where it came from. And also to show Linda some of our sayings.
And not politically correct in there.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes. Speaking.
Yes.
Yeah. That whole thing.
So, has anybody got any kind of tips or advice or things that they think could be done to improve it?
Oh, I just enjoyed it so much. I didn't even think about that.
What I thought, and as a standalone sketch, I think it's absolutely fine, you know, but if it's part of a bigger thing, I would have liked to see the Ethel and Nellie having more distinct personalities. Mm. They speak with the same voice, and although when you read it, of course, it's they are more distinct. Yeah. But they don't seem to have a different way of speaking, a different, you know. Mm-hmm. And obviously they're from the same neighbourhood and they've been brought up in the same area, but they might have something to distinguish them. So I felt
one might be the eternal optimist and one the eternal pessimist. Mm-hmm.
Yes, right. Yeah.
One could be racist and one could be obsessed with sex. If you want to bring in that stuff.
I just thought they were a little bit generic old ladies. Yeah. And I thought, well, if you look around this table, there's no generic old ladies.
There's
here.
No old ladies around.
There's no generic ladies here. We're all indigenous.
There's no ladies. That's true.
That's true as well. So forget that. But you know, that was the only thing. But as a standalone, I think it's fine. But if it was going to be actually, or you know, go into a bigger piece of into a play or. Yeah. A short play, I'd like to see them with a little bit more definition.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's got definite potential as a particularly as a short play.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Mm. Yeah. 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 One act play, a 15, 20 minute play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so. Marvelous. Very good.
I think first time out was writing dialogue.
Really good. Yeah. And is that well observed or well listened?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think what would be interesting as well, and possibly a useful exercise from your point of view, in developing dialogue, would be actually to rewrite it, putting the dialogue into prose piece.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then adding in the body movements.
Yes.
And
some descriptive detail as well.
And then you'd have a good short story to enter into competitions.
Wow. Right. Oh, and they're on the way to the day centre, aren't they?
Yes.
What a pity you're not an adult. Thank you.
Well,
thank you, Heaven. Well done. That's brilliant. Now, Pat, you grew up with some curious words and expressions, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I was reminded by that, and some of them, obviously, I was very familiar with. But there are a couple that Heather didn't sort of include that I grew up with.
Where did you grow up?
Manchester, which is not far from where Heather was.
I was born and brought up in Manchester. Mm-hmm. Okay, that would be Manchester, England.
England, yes. One of my gran's favourites, which I've adopted, was a blind man on horseback will never notice. You know,
a blind man on horseback will never notice.
Yeah, if something wasn't quite right, if it wasn't as good as it should be. Yeah. My gran, I think, had a tendency to be a little bit slapdash.
I've got one of those that my husband uses, coming from a mining community. It's near enough for pit work. In other words, you're not making a cabinet, you're making a pit prop. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect, so it's good enough.
Yeah. And down in Portsmouth, it's, old man on a galloping horse.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing, man on a galloping horse.
I think it's a version of a more common saying. Mm. I think the galloping horse is more common.
Mm. It seems to have combined two, doesn't it? Yeah. A blind man won't notice, a man on a galloping horse won't notice.
Yeah. Friend, a former colleague, when I said something, used the expression. She said, "Oh, my man, he was always from Ashton." My man on the horseback from Ashton will never know.
These things, that's what's so wonderful about language. It's so creative, and every individual is creative with language and changes it and modifies it.
Yeah, it's just about the change, I think.
Well, pretty soon that'll be a short story. Please tell it.
In Heather's piece, she talked about face like a smacked ass. Mm-hmm. But the expression I grew up with, and I haven't heard it used anywhere else, was face like a battered pluck.
Never heard that.
Battered pluck. And the pluck is the lungs, the intestines, and the liver.
Is it?
Used as food. And I have this vague memory, because we used to have a dog, and I have a vague memory of something horrible and pink being boiled on top of the stove.
Yeah.
And being told that was pluck.
Mm-hmm.
But where the expression came from, I have no idea.
Battered pluck.
A battered pluck. Could it be battered? It's two possible means. Yeah. One, it's been bashed up a bit, or it's been dipped in batter and then fried
to make it more palatable.
More like the bashed up.
That's yes, what I thought.
This
yeah.
squishy.
Yeah,
the
I have a friend who used to do that, and we called it the lights. The plug,
yeah.
It's the same thing.
We called it the lights. Yeah,
yeah. But she used to get them for nothing from the butcher and cook them up for her.
But
dog.
Was it kind of like a pink?
Yeah, would have been. Yeah, would have been. Yeah.
I'm feeling rather nauseous.
I'll move on. I mean, we're also talking about political correctness. We're talking about faces. When I was teaching, we used to describe certain pupils as having a face born to be smacked.
Oh, that's so unpolitically correct.
The other one is a face for radio.
Yeah.
Or podcasting.
Podcasting, yeah. But then we've mentioned language change in action. One of the phrases that I think has become come into currency sort of in the last 20 years. One of the phrases that I think has become come into the language over the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years or so is the world's your lobster.
Mm. The world's your lobster.
Not yeah. the world's your oyster.
Which, well, of
it's
course
evolved.
It was.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
But obviously the lobster is meant to, that it's not quite as exciting and up
no,
to upmarket.
It's nothing to do with that. It was, until I actually looked it up, I was firmly convinced that it came from the character Hilda Ogden in Coronation Street.
I had the feeling it had come from a Malapropism.
Malapropism, yeah. yeah, and because she was famous for them.
Yes,
she
was.
And that was strange comments. So I thought, you know, it was definitely her. People use it.
Mm-hmm.
It just, it's, you know, people have heard it and so on.
Right.
But then when I looked it up, it was also apparently used by Arthur Daly.
Oh, right.
In an episode of Minder.
Right.
And the scriptwriter for Minder had heard the expression used in his local.
Yes.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah.
And I'll give it to Arthur Daly. To say it. So which one came first? I'm not entirely sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think my money's still on Hilda Ogden.
Mm-hmm.
But it is. It's a great example of, you know, how language changes and of the richness of our language.
Right.
It is,
you know,
and it can be very local as well. I mean, I remember
yes.
My grandmother and grandfather used the expression, I'll give it to Weddle. If you said, Grandma, where do you want this to go? She'd say, give it to Weddle. And I didn't know where it had come from. Now, Weddle was a football player for Portsmouth. When they didn't know what to do with the ball, they used to give it to, everyone used to shout, give it to Weddle! This is like from the 1930s. And so within that very small community,
yeah.
mm-hmm.
give it to Weddle is well understood.
Yeah.
I don't suppose they know now where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, give it
but to Weddle. And it would, you know, if somebody from that area that was, it became one of the phrases they
yeah.
used, you know, they
yeah.
moved away and their family would grow up with
yeah.
it and somebody else would pick it up.
Yeah.
And that's how
I'll check with my brother-in-law because, I don't know if you know, a few years ago there was a kind of fans buyout at Portsmouth, so
yes,
he's
yeah.
one of the fans that got involved,
yeah.
so he might know. Well,
yeah.
I'd be interested to see if
it was
still
Jack Weddle
mm-hmm.
was the...
Yeah.
The,
yeah.
Well, carrying on with the subject of, you know, language and how it's evolved and so on, Teresa and Nicola, you spoke to Jill Simpson, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Let's have a listen to that now.
Today we're talking to Jill Simpson, former senior lecturer in linguistics at the University of Central Lancashire. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
So, Jill, what is political correctness?
It's a way of speaking and acting in order to avoid causing offence to people who, usually people in particular groups, maybe minorities, maybe not, by the language and the actions that you use. It's done to avoid offence and to avoid, I think, probably inciting others
right.
to do that.
Okay. So where did it come from?
In terms of history, it seems to be quite a difficult question to answer. But there was a time, I think around the 1930s, is one of the first instances I've been able to find, when it was used in its literal sense, by, say, people affiliated to a political party, to say that this or that term does not conform to the ideology of that party. So, you know, literally, it's not the correct way of thinking. But it seems to have been used, as far as I can tell, in print by, I've got a reference, Tony Cade, I think it is, in a book called The Black Woman, 1970. And that, as far as I can tell, is the first recorded instance of it being used in its modern sense. Although I have also read that it was being used ironically around, especially in the US, on campuses, by feminists, and that that's how it probably, that's around about the same time as Tony Cade's book too. So used in the same way, ironically to begin with, and then by her, in order to point out that it was the wrong way to behave.
Okay, thanks. And what's your own attitude to it?
I think we probably might have picked it up on the way. I think it's an almost impossible question to solve. We must try to behave in a way that doesn't offend other people, and that doesn't incite others to offend other people. But no matter how we try, language is so slippery that as soon as a new term is invented, that becomes eventually a slur again. But differently able, for instance, just to use one of the ones we had as an example, it's not difficult to see children shouting in the playground, "Oh, you're differently abled," because no matter how we try, they start to use those terms derogatively.
We can't control language, and we can't control the way that an individual interprets, exploits it, and changes it.
We can't, no.
I think special needs is an example where if we want to, you know, be a bit rude about someone's intellect, we say, well, they're a bit special, you know.
Anyone who's around teenagers, I've got a 23-year-old and 20-year-old now, but they're hanging out with their friends. I've just been home for a week, and they, you know, we went out several evenings with them, and the language they use, it's almost a different language because they subvert the meaning of everything. And I think that's one, it's one thing that just shows how dynamic our language is all the time.
Creative, yeah.
It is, yeah. Yes, I don't think, no matter how hard we try, we're not going to stop it.
No. It's like King Canute holding back the waves. It's not going to happen.
But we still have to make the effort.
Yes.
I think we always have to try to do it, but I personally would accept that it can't be done.
A question from Linda, and she is interested to know what you think about classics and racial slurs or racial stereotype. And she particularly mentions Mark Twain's use of the N-word and stereotypes, especially in Huckleberry Finn. And this has come up because both Linda and her husband have taught in American universities, and she feels it's necessary to the authenticity of the book, but that found that many African-American students felt insulted and offended by it.
Yes. This was really interesting question. So I had a look around and sort of to see what other people were saying about this. And I found an article by Peter Messant in The Guardian, which I'll give you a reference for later. And he says that Mark Twain's repeated use of that derogatory term in Huckleberry Finn is absolutely deliberate, ringing with irony. And I think that's the way to go. I agree with him, and I think Mark Twain intended to highlight the unacceptable nature of discrimination, racial discrimination in particular, he was talking about then. I can see that is going to cause problems. I can only imagine what it's like to be a black child sitting in a classroom, if it is a child, or anyway, an older student, a black student sitting in the classroom I'm hearing those awful terms again and again and again, because it comes up again and again and again. And the ideas that the book exposes. Yeah, as I say, I can only imagine what it feels like to be that student. It's not for me to tell teachers how to do their job, and I'm sure they've thought of it already. But I guess I would think the only way to work it is to try and show them that Mark Twain is on their side, and that it, what he wants to do is to show how unacceptable it is by his satire on these that particular part of society in the US at the time. And
interesting you should say that, because I read it as a very, I was brought up in a very liberal family, and I lived in a part of the southeast that was very white, and there was only one black family, and we were friends with some of those children. I read it and I didn't feel that the author was being racist at all. I definitely got that impression that he was on the side of the downtrodden. So that's interesting that you should say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as I was saying, that's, I think it would be a great pity to leave out literature of that kind because of the words that it uses, when the words are not used intentionally to insult or denigrate or discriminate against people.
A couple of things occur to me. One is it's sort of part of a wider debate now about people's sensitivities and books being banned almost from university syllabuses in case they upset someone. That's one thing. But I was also thinking about a book which I think is very racist, very anti-Semitic, and is not widely read these days, which is Trilby by Du Maurier. I can't remember his name. Daphne Du Maurier's grandfather. It's not, but it's not widely read, and it is. The characterization of Svengali is very, very anti-Semitic, and I think that's probably one of the reasons that people don't read it, and it hasn't survived because it's totally out of step with modern sensibilities.
I haven't read it, but I suppose I can see the dilemma that the university authorities face when students are coming to them and saying, this shouldn't be allowed, this is racist. But really, that's what you want your students to learn, to be able to look at something critically and to see when it is actually sending a message to language and the ideas within it.
The question we had from Stephanie about widely available academic sources that you might recommend to help establish the legitimacy of a word to add authenticity through a manuscript. And I think that she means, for instance, like possibly if a term is anachronistic, writing in a period novel and it's out of step. Do you know of any such work? Or
I think such a work wouldn't fit on your shelves. I think you have to, because it would have to be sort of check it out every single word, and we're talking, well, millions. I think, and I'm not an author of that kind, and this is just my common sense reaction would be that you need an etymological dictionary or access to one. So first of all, you can establish the time periods and the history of words, and the examples that they give you. They usually cite particular literature, newspapers, and those kinds of things. So you will be able to find exactly when that word came into the language, and then follow that up with just having a look at one or two of those sources, whether it be their newspapers, be they popular contemporary fiction, and have a look at what they're saying. It kind of brought to mind Jane Austen and Northanger Abbey, and I thought, and she puts into the mouth of Catherine Morland, the heroine, these kind of words and phrases, and in the way she behaves, I suppose what would have been a teenager of the time. So I mean, and I can remember reading, when I was a teenager, I really got hooked on Georgette Heyer, I don't know if you ever read any.
Yes, I've read lots of that.
And the Regency language and the own law and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know where she got her from, but that's how I'd go about it. I'd sort of look up the etymology first to find out when they came into the language and some of the sources, and then go to some of those sources and see if those words were actually used at the time. I don't know any other way.
Okay, thank you. That's good advice. And this question from Andy Larter about being PC. For example, using the word cripple is not appropriate nowadays. But, when yes. is it appropriate? If you're writing it, again, it's about writing in a period, isn't it? And authenticity of character. Because in the Victorian era, somebody wouldn't say, Spike was differently abled. Or, yeah.
So. Right. I wasn't sure I'd understood Stephanie properly. I mean, so I was thinking more in terms of a contemporary character.
Actually, I think you're right. I think there are two questions, and I put them together because one was from Stephen, one was from Andy, and they both mentioned the word cripple. So you're right. There are two things. So one is about a contemporary character and authenticity of character who is not somebody who's not politically correct, and the other is about historical fiction, I think.
Right. Okay. So if it's a contemporary character and they use differently abled in a straight. Forward way, I'd say they were trying to be politically correct, because that's the kind of term that you get in the sheets that are given out to people like social workers, police, educators. These are the terms to use. Don't use this term, and so on. However, it would depend on the character, I think, whether they were actually using it in an attempt to be politically correct, or whether they were being ironic, in which case they would be intending the opposite. And I think in that case, you'd have to establish elsewhere whether this character was straightforward or not.
Yeah, so it's all about tone, isn't it?
I think that's not the only way. You'd have to use other ways of showing what the character was like, I suppose.
Right. And in the historical context, I mean, again, this is only, I think it's a matter of opinion, isn't it? But I thought, Dickens can do it, but can we? If we're writing set in the 19th century.
I think you have to. Yeah. I think you have to. And I think and readers need somehow to be educated. I mean, perhaps you have to put a rider at the front of your piece and say, these characters are speaking as characters of the time would speak.
Yeah.
You can go on and say, no, there's no intention to offend anybody in the current.
Yeah, that's a good idea, isn't it? Because that would really set the tone right at the beginning, and then mm-hmm. people could read with no worry about what your intent was.
Yeah, I think sometimes, when you see people say Till Death Us Do Part was racist, and they're completely missing the point, in my opinion, because actually Alf Garnett was racist, but the programme itself was about being anti-racist and showing what an idiot this guy is.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, you're going to get the naive reader, I suppose, who takes things at face value and thinks the author is racist, perhaps when they're portraying a racist character or a bigoted character.
Yeah.
And that's isn't it even more important that schools and universities include...
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. It's all down to education. I mean, I wouldn't say there's nothing you can do for the people who've grown up using those terms. I mean, they're part of their idiolect. And in a way, you can understand the person in the street saying, don't tell me not to say this, not to say that. I've spoken like that my whole life. That's how I speak. You can understand that reaction. I guess it's only through education that you can sort of bring people to realise that it causes offence.
People of my mum's generation, for example, my mum uses the term coloured because that is the polite term, or that was the polite
term. It was.
And the correct term. And yet we've seen figures in the public domain being castigated as racist for using the word coloured when there was absolutely, I believe, no intention to offend.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it depends who's speaking, though. I think if you are, say, a politician, it behoves you to educate yourself.
Yeah.
In terms of how you speak about other people. I think probably you get to be that kind of figure in the public domain, then you should be
constantly up to date. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of the way language changes or is changed by use, I'm going to be talking in one of the podcasts just very briefly about what is either a mistake or a changing word, and that is something that I hear all the time on TV and doesn't annoy me, it just intrigues me, mischievous. Because I would say there's no such word as mischievous.
No, it's mischievous, isn't it?
Mischievous. But is it possible mischievous will become the norm as it's more used?
I'm sure it will. One that gets me is nuclear.
Oh yes.
But, once that's got common currency and is repeated by US presidents, for instance, that's it. It's gone. It's gone into the wide world. And probably more people are listening to Ronald Reagan than are to nuclear scientists who pronounce it differently. So it's gone. It can't be helped.
Okay, thanks.
Can I ask you obviously you've had a lifelong love of language and find it fascinating. What are you doing in your retirement?
Nothing.
Are you just enjoying the gardening?
Nothing. That's why I was... No. What am I doing in my retirement? I'm not doing anything really to do with language formally, apart from enjoying it and using it and reading about it and things like that.
Yeah.
I went walking the dog.
Oh, lovely. That's always good.
Well, my daughter's doing an open university degree at the moment, but she's hoping in a couple of years to go to Holland to do an MA in linguistics. But,
I'd recommend it, but then I would, wouldn't I?
Yes, yeah. Well, obviously, she's finding it the most interesting part of her degree. So
good. Right, I did make a list in the good academic way of things that I'd read or things that looked interesting to read. So I'll email you the list to Rachel, and then if you want to pass that on to other people.
When we do the podcast each week, then usually Stephanie puts on Facebook links to books that we've mentioned or books that are interesting. So we can add it there to Facebook, if that's okay with you.
Right, yes, I'll email you that list, yeah.
Okay, lovely, thank you very much. Well, it's been lovely talking to you.
Lovely to meet you.
Enjoy Madrid. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
That was very interesting. I'm fascinated by the origination of political correctness. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and its connection with the feminist movement. Mm, yeah, very interesting. And Linda, what did you think?
Well, I was interested in her remarks about Huckleberry Finn and Mark Twain and knowing exactly what he was doing, and I'm sure he did. But at the time he wrote the book, I don't think there was that kind of sensitivity about the N-word, et cetera, was there? But also, my husband was a professor, and in his classes, he liked to read Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn in particular, and he had classes were then with African American people, white people, and he asked in the class, "Does this offend you if I'm saying, we're reading Mark Twain?" And he uses this word quite a lot, and about half of the African Americans said no, because they understood the context. But there was another group of them, quite a few, who said yes, they found it very offensive, even though they knew the context. And so I don't know what you would do in a situation like that.
Well, you've got an interesting take on that.
Oh, yes. Well, my children are mixed race, and my ex-husband was half Nigerian, although he did grow up as the only black boy in a white school and a white Jewish school at that, so that must have been an interesting context for him. But they are very... they all treat it very lightly. We did have one incident. I grew up in a very white town. My mother was very liberal, and she brought us all up to be non-racist and non-homophobic. And as a consequence, I was friends with the only black children in the town. And one of my friends was gay when I was about 16 or 17. And, you know, she had open house at our place, and none of that language was ever allowed. I went on to marry Irving, and my kids grew up initially in London. I mean, I remember looking around in London and being the only white person on the bus in Brixton. And then we moved to Sussex, which again was very white orientated. And my kids were very happily grew up. And they only had one incident where my son was chased across a field by a bunch of boys, and his friends protected him. But the boys were shouting the N-word at him, and it was reported to the police, and they were prosecuted, and my son had to go to court and testify.
Wow.
He said it wasn't the word that upset him so much; it was the feeling of hate that he got off the person.
Right.
So it wasn't what he was saying; it was how he was saying it.
Yeah.
And I think there is a context for every word. I don't believe in banning any word.
Yeah.
I think there is a context.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and we talked about this before. There's the one of the early plays written by an African-American is called The Electronic Nigger, and it has been produced recently off Broadway, I believe. You know, it's still, and you have to be able to talk about that play, you know, without, you know, fudging the word, I think.
Uh-huh.
And there are songs that use the
word. Rap artists are a particularly interesting example because they've seized the word and made it their own. And you know, same way my children do, you know, they just call things at home, you know, their Chromecast is called Nigger Town. But I wouldn't dream of using that word.
Exactly,
you know, it's all
exactly.
Like, it's a bit like, you know, if you're Irish, you're allowed to make Irish jokes. You know, I don't know how it works, really, but...
Okay, the thing that we didn't discuss with Jill there was profanity, and, you know, profanity and blasphemy are part of everyday language. In fact, blasphemy has found its, you know, it has evolved and become other words, like blimey.
Yeah.
Well, core blimey apparently was God blind me originally.
Really?
So,
yeah.
So how do you feel about using profanity in your writing? How about you, Linda? How do you deal with that?
Well, I don't think I have any trouble at all with using it in context. And they use profanity. It's part of their character. And so I have no hesitation about using what we would call curse words, you know, in that context. I don't think I would ever be comfortable writing the N-word in some way. For some reason, it just so puts me off so much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could write it. But profanity, I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's what's appropriate for what you're writing and the characters.
Yeah.
So if you're writing gritty, urban, contemporary thriller,
Trainspotting.
Trainspotting. That's when, like, if Jane Austen wrote Trainspotting, what a different book that would be. So, you know, yeah, it's what's appropriate. Obviously, what I'm writing at the moment, swearing doesn't really come into it, you know, because it's a kind of cozy scenario. But I wrote a short play a few years ago, and one of the characters is just a very, very sweary woman. And it's based on a real-life friend of mine. And so it starts with swearing, and they're swearing all the way through it because it wouldn't be natural, it wouldn't be appropriate to her. And I have to say, no one, you know, when it won a competition, but nobody said, oh, you know, we liked your play, but it was a bit sweary. That it wasn't mentioned, it wasn't challenged at all.
I wanted to see Once a Catholic in London when it was first out. Loved it, absolutely great play. And then some years later, I read it, and I thought, oh, my God. And there was such a lot of swearing in it that having seen it on stage, it was so much in context, so much of the character.
You didn't notice.
So you just
you
don't
notice
it. And sometimes it can be about that. But reading it, it was like hitting me in the face. And I thought, had I just read it? Well, I probably still would have gone to see it.
Yeah.
I get a completely different perspective on it.
Yeah, because it seemed natural for people speaking. Yeah,
I suppose if you're writing sci-fi, you can invent your own language.
Yes, I don't know if I would, though, because you know, there's enough to contend with the strange names. But I always think there's nothing funnier than a posh bird swearing. I mean, I do a podcast with a very posh bird, and she... posh bird is a lady who is beautifully brought up and would not normally swear, but when she drops the F-bomb, it's quite funny. And also, you know, I've noticed that I swear a lot less being out here around people who don't swear so much. So I think perhaps you pick it up from your environment.
Maybe so.
Yeah. But I don't mind reading it at all. I don't mind. I was interested, you know, about the Henry Miller book. The C word is a word that I am not really very comfortable with. Because it denigrates women, I think. Yeah. And then that gives it more charge for me than just the F-bomb.
There's something about it that's more vulgar than the other words.
Yeah.
My daughter spent 6 months in Australia, and before she went out, she would swear occasionally, but when she came back, the language was terrible.
Or improved, depending on the point of view.
But it would be in the middle of a word, you know, sort of she'd say the F word in the middle of something, and it was really quite noticeable.
Quite shocking, isn't it, when it's someone you're not expecting it from.
Swearing increased as a result of this one colleague of mine, whose background was Irish. And I think the Irish have a very different approach to, or attitude.
Yes, they almost don't think of it as a swear word.
The language is
I find that very hard to imagine, Pat, because you're such a lady.
Oh, really? I'm sorry, the PE staff, male PE staff, or one of them actually complained about...
your language?
Not just mine, but our
language.
Oh, that's astonishing.
Well, I find I try to avoid the profanity. It probably at the expense sometimes of being real. But I like to save it so that there's only two or three F words in the whole novel. But I think that when it came to it, there was no other word that would have done. It had to be that word.
And sometimes that's great because it gives a much bigger impact.
That's what I hope. And certainly, I don't mind blasphemy so much, but I'm obviously sensitive. There's one character in Lack in Grace which is a very pious person and talks about hearing the word of God, and Grace says to her, "Well, you want to watch it, they might lock you up." so it is kind of taking a bit of a poke at religion, but hopefully in context it won't be too offensive. It's an easy joke.
You can't please everybody. You've got to do what's right. And what, like you say about you using the appropriate word, that really applies to all your writing. You know, it's not like we're all kind of sitting there thinking, "Oh, I better not put a swear word," or whatever.
No, absolutely.
It's either appropriate or not.
But I think blasphemy and racism is much harder to deal with, because obviously, you know, there are certain, you know, cultures that would be very offended. I mean, you know, we don't need to go into the details, but in recent years we've seen, you know, Salman Rushdie and the whole thing that happened in Paris with the culting.
But as I mentioned to Jill, "Till Death Us Do Part," which many people thought was racist, but of course it wasn't. It was Alf Garnett was being shown up as a racist idiot.
A bigot,
yes.
And also a misogynist, because he's called his wife a silly old moon.
You have to be able to write those characters and give them things to say that are not normally acceptable if that is their character.
And of course, around the same, just slightly after that, was Rising Damp, where there was a tall black medical student. He was very cultured, but the landlord was just had so many stereotypes about black people.
Exactly, it was brilliant. Actually, Rising Damp, very very that well done, and again showing up the foolishness of Rigsby with his racist
Rigsby. That was it.
I just think with "Till Death Us Do Part," the argument is that it was showing him up, but how many of the audience
appreciated that.
Well, we don't know. But certainly, I got it.
You can't legislate for that.
No, exactly.
I know people who chose not to watch it because they found it offensive, but that's another choice we make, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, we hope you'll share your views and ideas on how to deal with the issues of controversial language. You can go on to Write Club, the podcast Facebook group, and tell us there what your challenges are or how you're dealing with it. We'd love to know what you think. It's almost time to end, but before we do, there's just time to hear what's on Charlie Bell's bedside table.
Charlie Bell, what's on your bedside table?
I'm currently reading 4321 by Paul Auster. First of his books that I've read. He's a really prolific author, but this particular one won the Man Booker in 2017, and I read a news article about it. So it wasn't a personal recommendation. So I'm reading that one at the moment and really, really enjoying it.
Good. He's one of the colleagues on the podcast read it and raved about it. And then somebody else started reading it and hated it. That's really interesting that you say that.
You said you started reading it and didn't like it.
No. Another colleague. I haven't started it yet.
Home. Yeah, I can see why people wouldn't like it because it's kind of four stories about the life of the same man born in 1947. Kind of the stories run simultaneously but on totally different paths. It's beautifully written, but you've got to really switch on to stay with it because it goes back and forth and doesn't hit you over the head with any direction. You're not told this is guy one or guy two or guy three or guy four. You've got to kind of, you find yourself actually flicking back 200 pages to go, oh yeah, that's what he did last time, right? And so you're reading four stories in one. I think it's brilliant. I'm not finished it yet, but I'm really enjoying it. I mean, the blurb on the back kind of sums it up very well, as blurbs on the back are supposed to, I suppose. As each version of Ferguson is the character, as each version of Ferguson's story rushes across the fractured terrain of mid-20th century America, a boy grows up again and again and again. And that's why it's so interesting, is because they pick the perfect few decades, because you've got post-Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, JFK, da-da-da-da-da. And you're coming at it from four different directions. Really, really good.
Good. Thank you. That was excellent. Excellent. Okay. I know Teresa's going to be arguing that you should be the bedside table on her show because she loves that book.
Well, that was a strong vote for Paul Auster's 4321.
Yeah, great book. Life-changing.
Life-changing.
So, Linda, what's on your bedside table at the moment?
On my nightstand are several partially read books, which I can't put down, of course, but the one that currently holds my attention is an old favorite that I'm rereading, Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. Have you read that?
No.
Oh, it's wonderful. I love her work. So straightforward and warm. And funny, it's subtitled Some Instructions on Writing and Life.
Oh.
And she tells how the title came about, and it's just so fitting for those of us who kind of get, stuck. And she says, 30 years ago, my older brother, who was 10 years old at the time, was trying to get a report on birds written that he had 3 months to write, which was due the next day. We were out in our family cabin in Bolinas, and he was at the kitchen table close to tears, surrounded by binder paper and pencils and unopened books on birds, immobilized by the hugeness of the task ahead. Then my father sat down beside him, put his arm around my brother's shoulder, and said, "Bird by bird, buddy. Just take it, bird by bird." It's wonderful.
That's good.
And so she says another thing that I really like. She says, "Say to yourself in the kindest possible way, look, honey, all we're going to do for now is to write a description of the river at sunrise, or the young child swimming in the pool at the club, or the first time the man sees the woman he will marry. That is all we're going to do for now. We are just going to take this bird by bird, but we are going to finish this one short assignment." And I think it's just a wonderful way to approach your writing. Mm-hmm. When it gets overwhelming, just stop and say, bird by bird, mm-hmm. just this one scene.
I used to have a mentor who used to say, just say to yourself, just get the file out. You're not saying you're going to do anything with it. You're not saying you're just going to get the file out and put it on the table. Mm-hmm. And then once it's out, you open it.
Yeah.
And it all flows from there.
So that's Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott.
Anne Lamott. L-A-M-O-T-T.
Right. Okay. Lamott. Lovely. Well, we'd love to know what's on your bedside table too. And if you'd like to share that with us, then just record a short 2-minute piece giving us the title and the author, why you chose the book, and what it's about. But no spoilers, please. Email it to us at contributions@writeclubthepodcast.com. We'll post details of how to do that on our Facebook group. Well, thanks again for joining us. And if you haven't already, please do subscribe to Write Club the Podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And don't forget, our short story competition closes in just a few days. So you need to get your entry to us if you're going to be in with a chance to win our book bag of stationery and books. Details of how to enter are on the Write Club the Podcast Facebook group and page. We need up to 2,000 words on the theme of On the Way, emailed to us before midnight UK time on the 31st of May. We'll look forward to welcoming you again next week when I'm going to be speaking to Laura Marshall, author of Friend Request, and we'll be discussing thrillers. Until next week, goodbye!
Bye! Bye.